This is Rolling Stone Music Now, and today is Metal Day. Rolling Stone just published its online list of the 100 greatest heavy metal albums of all time. And to talk about it, we have the editors behind that list, our resident metal obsessives, Corey Groh and Hank Steamer, as well as Brittany Spanos. And along the way, they reached out to a number of metal legends to put together their own top 10 lists. And among those was an actual metal god, Rob Halford of Judas Priest. And we're about to be joined by Rob Halford himself. But in the meantime, guys, what was the thinking behind the criteria for the list? How did you define metal? And we'll get more deeply into this later, but very quickly, what was the thinking?
This is something that Hank and I were talking about. This is Corey. The starting point of metal, in a way, was, you know, Black Sabbath's first album, you know, coming out of Birmingham, England, and they had just that really direct sound. And so we decided that was kind of the first pure metal album, and we kind of worked on that. You know, just the sound of those three notes that open that song, and just kind of the history of it after that.
And that was sort of the dividing line.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so it had the powerful guitars, it had the acrobatic drumming, it had the aggressive vocals, the piercing vocals, that sort of a thing. And we kind of used that. I don't know if you want to build off that, Hank.
Yeah, and I think in a superficial way, tons of other rock music at that time had a lot of these characteristics. But I think that there's just like a certain kind of darkness to Sabbath that was, I think of as like a line in the sand. I think that if you take things like Zeppelin, Cream, some of the other music at the time, you know, again, it's got a lot of the same things coming, you know, going on. I mean, these bands were basically like heavy blues bands, or bands just like cranking up blues, but Sabbath took it somewhere else. And I think our mission was to kind of like separate out that thread as it's like moved up through the decades.
And to be clear, that meant no Led Zeppelin, no AC/DC.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we ruled out a lot of things that I think in the common parlance would be considered, you know, quote unquote metal classics, heavy metal classics, whatever you want to say. I mean, you know, a record like Appetite for Destruction, record like Back in Black, you know, kind of we took the stance of making like fairly strict criteria that you know helped us to come up with some kind of like to framework that we could carry this through and really spotlight some more of the, you know, the places that metal has gone in the last, say, 20 years or something, and to really get into those subgenres like death metal and black metal and grindcore and you know, up to the present day, things like Death Heaven. I think that like making that distinction between, you know, what we call hard rock and you know, what is metal, what is heavy metal, allowed us to follow that thread further than we would have maybe been able to had we, you know, because it's like if Zeppelin or something is on there, it's like, you know, a lot of the list is going to be taken up with, you could make a whole list of 60s and 70s rock, you know, if you're sort of taking it there.
Sort of proto-metal, metal-ish.
Yeah,
yeah.
Things like that. And like, I think that, you know, again, these distinctions are subjective, but we made them in a way that made sense to us, and we just tried to stick to those kind of guidelines as we move through the decades.
When we were talking before the show, you defined metal in actually the same way that the Supreme Court once defined obscenity, which is you know it when you hear it. But can you do you want to get, and besides something that follows in the vein of Black Sabbath, do you guys want to get a little closer to maybe an actual definition of metal?
There's sort of an aggression that we're looking for. There's sort of a heaviness of the guitar tones. You know what I mean? It's something that separates it from rock and roll that you hear in like a lot of like heavier like rock and roll and that sort of a thing. But yeah, it's a darkness. It's an aggression. It's a, you know, it's an excitement that's maybe a little bit different. It's a different feeling.
And I think also as you move into some of, especially like the UK stuff, like the classic, you know, obviously Priest and Maiden and things like that, like there's this almost like epic kind of, you know, grandeur to the music that's just like, it's just sort of set apart, and it kind of like ties into the whole image of metal as this like heroic kind of triumphant, you know, just way of expressing yourself musically that really bridged off from, you know, what we would call rock and roll or just, you know, kind of a more like just the way that hard rock would feel, I guess.
On the first Black Sabbath album, there's a song, The Wizard, that is driven largely by harmonica.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of like shade and light up.
There's absolutely
on there, yeah.
And I think it's important to note that Sabbath were a blues band, you know, like, you know,
early, yeah.
Yeah, just you know, that's sort of where all this stuff started, you know, with these British bands in the 60s. I mean, was, you know, bands covering, you know, blues in clubs, but I think that like Sabbath, like they turned a page somehow. Do you know what I mean? Like the first song in the first Black Sabbath album, like it just represents a dividing line in the way that like rock music could feel. And I think that, you know, enough so that it can be called a different thing. And I guess that's what we're trying to trace.
At the same time, the number one album on the list is not the first Black Sabbath album. It's the next one, Paranoid. And basically, the answer for that, I assume, is simple. It's a better album, right?
It is.
How did that kind of work, that discussion?
It was pretty much when we first started out, we knew that it would be a Black Sabbath record. The only other thing that could possibly challenge that is Master of Puppets, which is number two on the list. But Sabbath just defined it. And the thing is, like, the first album is maybe a little more raw, and it, you know, it's number five on the list, on our list. But, you know, it was a little more refined on Paranoid, and Paranoid has a little bit more breadth in the styles that are on there, because Paranoid, the song is very fast, War Pigs is very heavy, Iron Man is very heavy, you know, there's all this moodiness to Hand of Doom. There's a little bit more depth to it than the first one, and that's why that was number one. But obviously the first album is incredible, and we wanted to, you know, pay tribute to that, and that's why we made it number five.
Yeah, I remember very early on the discussions that the whole thing was extremely vague, but we just kind of looked at each other and said, Paranoid and Master, and we'll figure everything else out. Mm-hmm. Like, we had nothing. Those were just like the stakes in the ground, and then we moved ahead from there.
And why Master of Puppets by Metallica? Why was that so clearly like sort of the number two or even a possible number one for you guys?
There's just a heaviness. There's an intricacy to it. There's a sophistication to Master of Puppets that isn't on maybe the earlier Metallica records. There's a maturity to it that just worked perfectly.
So rumor has it that we may really be joined now by Rob Halford. Let's check if that is true.
Yes, it's true. I'm here.
Hi, Rob. Hey, welcome to the show.
Guys.
Hey, I was curious for you, and I would say you're something of an authority on this issue. What makes a metal album as opposed to a hard rock album or something else? What is the distinguishing, or what are the distinguishing characteristics for you?
Yeah, these days it's kind of blurred lines, isn't it, to some extent? But, I've been making metal for over 40 years, so I come from the very beginnings and the roots of it. So I think for me, it's basically the simplicity of the performance from a basic band, you know, drums, bass, initially one guitar player and a singer. And it's that way that metal became defined, coming out of the, you know, the early blues, electric, progressive rock, the vibes that were going on down here in the UK in the 60s, to some extent. You know, it was by the end of the 60s that metal became truly defined out of all of those genres. So for me, it really is that very almost kind of primitive element of all of those instrumental characteristics, the way the drums and the bass and the lead guitar, and I'm talking about essentially riffs, the heaviness of the simple playing riff and the definitive simplicity of a heavy drum beat, and then obviously on top of that some vocals. But it's the hooks of the melodies, of the notes, of the instruments, and then the singing that's incorporated into it that really, for me, are the kind of base, the anchor, the roots of the metal sound.
Corey was wondering before the show if you remembered when you first kind of heard the term heavy metal and what you made of it and what associations you initially had with it.
Yeah, there wasn't really a moment for me, because, you know, growing up as a teenager, listening to all kinds of music, and especially the way that, you know, when you're in your early teens and you're going through that kind of developmental stage of, you know, angst and anger and fury at the world, and you're trying to find a music that touches you and kind of hits you with and something relative to those emotions. I was listening to early people, really, like the Stones, but then bands that were getting harder and stronger, like even bands like The Who, you know, The Simplicity of My Generation, and then obviously bands like Deep Purple, and by definition, we're not talking metal here, but we're talking about the heaviness of things coming through, and then obviously Jimmy Page laying down those tones and riffs with a whole lot of love and Communication Breakdown.
Very key moment there for that chugging.
You know, that was doing it for me. But so I can't remember an actual band or a time or a sound really until obviously somebody like Sabbath came along. That's when it became really solid, and you had a band to put a definition to heavy metal, Black Sabbath, in that respect. And we're talking about, what, like 68, 69, really, which ironically enough is the year that Judas Priest formed. So it's all around that end of the 60s as we lurch into the 70s when it all became very real.
Yeah.
Did you see Sabbath live? Like, I know they used to play like Henry's Blues House in Birmingham. Did you see like those early shows?
Yeah, I did. And it was just amazing, you know, because there was really no other band at the time that was making that kind of noise.
And the top album by your band on our list is British Steel. What sticks out in your mind about kind of making that album and the goals behind that album and just the general vibe as you guys were writing and recording that?
Well, we were in transition, really. We were moving. We just came back off a great tour with AC/DC in Europe, and we were at that time in our career where we were literally jumping off a big tour and going straight into the studio with very, very much kind of little or nothing type of things musically. But I think that the hookup with Tom Allen, Colonel Tom, who we've just been working with right now here in the UK on the next Priest album, along with Andy Sneap and Mike Exeter, but Tom came along, and I think being in Lennon's house and just really coming off that AC/DC tour with a lot of awareness of what that band was particularly doing. I think AC/DC are a great band in terms of songs and song structure, and whether that filtered into us. I've never really thought about this until now, Corey. Whether that filtered into us, I don't know. But we went into Lennon's old house with some very basic ideas, and those riffs like Living After Midnight, Breaking the Law, even Grinder, Rapid Fire Stealer, they all came out of where we were at that time in terms of our musical development. We were still really growing and trying to find who we were and what to do next. So British Steel is very raw and very organic in that respect.
So on your own list, we talked about Black Sabbath, the first album, which is your number one on the list, and then number two, you put Metallica, Kill 'Em All. What do you remember about hearing Metallica as someone who's already in a very famous metal band? And what impression did they make on you in that album in particular?
Just being aware, I think most of the musicians that I've put on my list, and I was checking the Rolling Stone 100 list yesterday. I think most of those musicians, we're all aware of each other. We're all curious. We're all interested about what we're doing, you know, respective bands. And being a British metalhead and having this great love for America and the culture of America, the rock and roll and metal scene of America, it was just very very obvious to me that something exciting was happening coming out of the Bay Area in general, not only Metallica, but obviously Slayer and Exodus and Testament and a ton of other bands. So, but Metallica were really leading the metal charge at that particular time with bands like with albums like Kill 'Em All, Ride the Lightning, and Justice for All. They were just really generating tremendous excitement throughout the country and the rest of the world, but particularly coming from the USA, Metallica, you know, everybody had their ears aimed at the sound that was coming from Metallica at that time.
And then the next thing on your list, speaking of really being open to new stuff, is Korn, the self-titled Korn album. There were some people of your generation who didn't like new metal and didn't respond to it, but you embraced it. Why?
Yeah, much as I'm doing now, and I listen to bands like Royal Blood, you know. When I put my top 10 list together for Rolling Stone, I wanted to emphasize this wasn't in any kind of chronological order of preference. These were just things that popped out of my head, and I was putting them down on my laptop. But with Korn, I remember I was in the Fight Band at the time, and I was working in the studio in Phoenix, and somebody sent me some of their songs. And this happens in music, in all kinds of music. You hear something coming out of the speakers that is incredibly fresh, and in this instance, it was for me, one of these game changer kind of experiences. So it was just the tone and of the way that the music was sounding, and the super heaviness, and again, Jonathan, being a singer, I'm always curious to hear the way singers interpret the metal sound that they're making, and Jonathan is doing something extraordinary, you know. So for me, when I heard Korn at that moment, much like on the other side of the coin, coming out of Seattle, when I heard Man in a Box by Alice in Chains, you know, I'm like, whoa, this is going to really shake things up, and that's what Korn did.
And number four on Rob Halford's list of the greatest heavy metal albums of all time is Iron Maiden. And speaking of reacting as a vocalist, I mean, when you first heard Bruce Dickinson, what was your impression of him?
This is the Paul Di'Anno album.
Oh, excuse me. So even a twist. Yes. A twist.
It's great, man. It's great. It's great. We're good friends, and with Iron Maiden especially, to see them burst forth so strongly and powerfully from the UK shores onto the worldwide scene was just a great thrill, you know, because all of us metal bands, we all have so many things in common, and this great dream and desire of getting your music out to as many people around the world as possible is still a thrill. And so, you know, we were just slightly off the page when this new wave of British heavy metal started to really, you know, make a noise out of the UK, and to see Maiden developing so strongly and so quickly, really, because there was this intense fury of activity here in the UK coming out of the back end of the punk new wave scene. In metal particularly, we were all terribly excited to see all of these great things happening in the UK, around the UK shore. So, when Bruce got a hold of the microphone and I heard his voice, I thought, man, this is it. This is the voice that's going to define and lead Maiden so strongly. And wow, what a great band to see them. So huge and still making great metal now is just it's a great kick. It's wonderful.
And Slayer, Rain in Blood is next.
Yeah, I love, you know, everybody knows I have this great love of all kinds of metal, all different subgenres of the word heavy metal, and Slayer's term for heavy metal is very unique and special. You know, coming out of that Bay Area scene around some of those other bands we've just mentioned, and for them to carve out their own particular style and niche in a unique way was great. And just the ferocity, the sheer intensity and power, you know, and especially off Raining Blood. And the language that they were using, you know, it was pretty evocative, you know, pretty strong, and saying a lot of things that I love to hear those kinds of bands say. Just great. And again, live. So the great thing about these bands that are on the 100 Rolling Stone list, but particularly the ones I hope I've picked from my top 10, you've got to go see these bands live, you know. Mm. It's one thing to hear a band coming out the speakers or in your ears, but your headphones, whatever. But to go and see them live is really the essence of what a band is. Because you can do all kinds of things in the studio, but to take a band live is the real moment of purity. And if you see Slayer live, it's just It's crazy, man. I love that band.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, the next album is Pantera. The thing that was interesting to me about that one is that was around when you worked with them, too, like slightly after that. You did the Light Comes Out of Black song. What do you remember about the first time that you heard Cowboys from Hell? Like, how did you discover this band?
Well, I'll quickly tell you the boring story everybody knows. I was the Priest was up in Toronto rehearsing for the 91 Painkiller tour, and I was in the hotel and watching the TV, and Dimebag was on the Much Music TV channel, and he was wearing the British Steel t-shirt, and I was listening to him talk. I had no idea who Pantera was, and listening to him talk, and then they played a few clips, and I'm like, man, what is this? This is crazy. So I called the station, said, you know, is he still there? Yeah. I jumped in the cab, went over. We met for the first time, and much like whenever you met Dimebag, he was a friend instantly, very accessible, very warm, very beautiful in the way he talked about music and people. So we became instant friends, and Pantera was playing that night at the club in Toronto, and I just went out and hung with him, you know, and I saw them play, and I'm just, you know, pinned against the wall. There was only a few people there, and Pantera was still, you know, kind of in that groundbreaking mode, but to watch that band at that moment playing to just a, you know, a small bunch of people, but playing it like they were playing to 1,000, 100,000, 1,000,000 people with such conviction was, again, like Korn, you know, like Slayer, you know, game-changing bands. And I was so thrilled with what I saw and heard, and hanging out with the guys. We took Pantera with us on the Painkiller tour of Europe, and I used to love standing on the side of the stage and watching them go out. So, like, you play Paris, and then I'd stand on the side of the stage and watch the band go on, and everybody's like, who is this band, you know? And nobody had heard of them. And this is the balls that the band had. They would walk out onto a stage, we are Pantera, now listen to this, and then we just tear the place apart. And within 20 minutes, by the end of their set, 30 minutes by the end of their set, the room was a shambles. You know, the venue was just, chairs were flying, people in making pits, and it was extraordinary. It was great memories from that moment of Pantera on the Cowboys from Hell release.
Well, Rob Halford, thanks so much for joining us. We couldn't have had someone better to join us to talk about the greatest metal albums of all time. And you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now, and we'll be back with a lot more metal.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
So we were going through our own list. Number one is Black Sabbath, Paranoid. Number two is Metallica, Master of Puppets. Number three is Judas Priest, British Steel. And we had the lead singer of that album talking about it, which is pretty cool. And number four is Iron Maiden, Number of the Beast. So what is it about that album? It, you know, obviously you have Bruce Dickinson in some ways kind of being like the metal vocalist. It's like, oh yeah, Robert Plant went here, I'm going here. That's part of the thing.
He had that whole operatic thing. Yeah. You know, his nickname was Bruce Air Raid Siren Dickinson. You know what I mean? He had that totally like commanding presence. And then when you paired that with Iron Maiden songwriting at the time, which were these long, epic, intricate, orchestral almost songs like Hallowed Be Thy Name, you know, It just blended perfectly with that. But at the same time, he had this kind of forceful quality that would work with a Run to the Hills. And it just was the perfect marriage of that. And also, you know, I don't know if I did this in my interview with Lars Ulrich recently, but I think he was saying that was also one of the first albums where there weren't lyrics already written. He wasn't going to have to sing Paul Di'Anno's lyrics, where Bruce could just create his own sound and his own thing, and it just all congealed into this amazing record.
What else about that album, Hank?
I mean, I guess like Corey said, Iron Maiden, it does represent like the pinnacle of like just sort of like drama and metal. I mean, obviously there's things like Dio, which you'll see later on the list, and you know, Black Sabbath, Heaven and Hell, and things like that. But I think that like Bruce Dickinson's arrival, like it set like a paradigm for a certain type of metal performance. And I think that, you know, we talked about this, one of the criteria we mentioned earlier was like a certain kind of darkness. And Iron Maiden is not necessarily the band, they have like a whole other thing going on. I think this is sort of evident in later albums like Power Slave, where there's just like a really like triumphant quality to Iron Maiden that allows them to like fill stadiums all over the world as they still do now. I think that whole strain of metal, you know, where the drama is so amplified, is, you know, as opposed to trying to like scare you or something, they're trying to sort of like, you know, get your blood pumping and like inspire you. It's not like Sabbath, where it's like this depressing, bleak, you know, it just extremely grim thing. It changes metal into like, you know, an inspiring force or something like that. Yeah. I think that's what Maiden.
It also helps that you have Bruce, who's like the most interesting man in metal. He fences, he flies planes, right. He, you know, does dog fights, you know, he lives that feeling that you're talking about.
It is funny, if you meet Bruce Dickinson, he's like the least sort of satanic dude on the planet. And yet there was a tendency towards that subject matter.
Look at the Number of the Beast.
Yeah.
666.
Next on the list is Black Sabbath's self-titled album, which we talked about a little bit. And next is Slayer, Rain and Blood. So why Slayer and why that album?
It's just the most intense thing. You know, obviously there are heavier records, there are more extreme records, there are grittier records, but there's just something about the intensity of Rain and Blood that you just don't hear on any other record, no matter how much people put into it. The fact that it starts at, I think, like 210 BPM, but just like with Rain and Blood, and you just, it's like, it just rattles you, and it just, it doesn't let up at all for 28 or 29 minutes, which feels like an hour because it's just so much.
And I think there was also something that we mentioned in the blurb that Corey wrote for that, which was the Rick Rubin production. It's just a huge like turning of the page in terms of how metal sounded on record. I mean, you can listen to earlier Slayer records and they're intense and they're very good, but they don't have this. The Rain and Blood has a violence and an in your face quality to the sound.
It's direct.
Yeah, I mean, it's like. It definitely set a bar for just like, you know, the drums are just so clear, and you know, Dave Lombardo, obviously, basically like Dave Lombardo being kind of like the quintessential fast metal drummer of all time. I mean, he's kind of like, and I think, you know, other drummers will tell you this, but I mean, in terms of just like that sort of like thrash bar being set, playing extremely fast double bass, just with like pummeling, relentless force. Like Dave Lombardo is the king of that, and Rain and Blood is like the album where you know you could just feel that from as soon as the record starts. It's like the drums are just like front and center.
And a fun fact about that you might remember from the Rick Rubin My Life and Songs we did is he actually turned up the drums on that, and that was one of the first albums he did that. He stripped away all of the reverb so you could actually hear what everyone was playing. And that's why you get a song like Angel of Death or Raining Blood that is just so direct.
Mm-hmm. In fact, let's hear the opening track from Slayer's Raining Blood, which is Angel of Death. So you guys are sure that's metal?
might be easy listening.
Next on the list, Motorhead, No Remorse. And that's actually a compilation album.
The only compilation album on this list.
So how did we end up there?
We couldn't, part of, you know, it begins with, what Motorhead album do you pick? There are just so many incredible ones. There's Ace of Spades. There's my favorite, which is Overkill. I love the first album. And so it's just one of these hard things where you needed to find the right cross-section that represented everything. And, you know, something about No Remorse, plus it has Killed by Death on it, which is an incredible song just because of the lyrics. You know, it's just Lemmy being dry and witty. But it has everything. It has all of the flavors of Motorhead from, you know, from when they formed until about 1984. And, it's all that's the singularity. You know, that's the thing that stood out to me about that blurb that J.D. Considine wrote is You could say that every Motorhead song sounds the same, but there's a singularity to each of them that has this special quality where if you listen to the song Overkill, you know, it's that drumming. If you listen to Ace of Spades, it's just his vocal hook, you know. He just was able to do that.
Let's hear Killed by Death by Motorhead. So what did Motorhead kind of symbolize in the kind of history of metal? What was their importance to you guys?
I think that Motorhead, and obviously a lot of this stuff was coming up when Lemmy died, but you know, we were talking about this Iron Maiden thing with this like sort of arena filling, like triumphant, dramatic, you know, paradigm of metal. Motorhead is in some ways the polar opposite. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Lemmy obviously was someone who was always name checking Chuck Berry and things like that. It's the rock and roll side of heavy metal. It's the side of heavy metal that is extremely gritty. It's extremely the idea that if it's in any way fancy, it's because I think that metal is, especially as you move into the 80s and 90s, the virtuosity of the playing becomes almost, you know, comedic. And certainly people have, you know, this idea of shred and this idea of just taking, you know, the maximal quality of metal. Motorhead represents, you don't need to make it fancier. You absolutely do not need to, like, quote unquote, improve this in any way. This is just like, you know, it was fine to begin with, and let's just roll.
It's that simplicity that Rob was talking about on the phone. Yeah. They just embodied that, you know, and then they also had the speed. They had the kind of punk side. They had the rock and roll side. And then it's just so heavy.
Well, right. I always think of them like writing a song in tribute to the Ramones. I think it's like a, mm-hmm. you know, it's an important thing because it's like, you know, I think Lemmy was all about like uniting these very primitive strains of rock and roll that were very catchy and like, you know, anthemic, like bar music almost, mm. you know what I mean? Which is a very, very different thing than like, I mean, Master Puppets, like Corey was saying, I mean, you're talking essentially like a, almost a classic, especially with coming from Cliff Burton, like it's almost a classical approach to metal and like a compositional one and like very epic and very, you know,
there's some Bach on that album right before Damage Inc. There's a little bit of Come Sweet Death.
Yeah. And so Motorhead is absolutely,
there's no classical on that. It's just classic.
So the next on the list is Megadeth, Peace Sells But Who's Buying. And I think to some of the uninitiated, people might have the impression that Megadeth is just sort of like a cut-rate Metallica. You know, that's sort of I think
it's so wrong.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's an informed opinion, but I've kind of heard that people, and I should mention for full disclosure that Corey Groh is wearing a Megadeth t-shirt right
I'm
now.
Biased. I'm very biased.
So there's actually a bunch of Megadeth albums on this list. So kind of explain and perhaps slightly defend Megadeth, especially people who might mostly know them for Dave Mustaine weeping in a Metallica documentary, which is an extremely unfair representation of a great man.
Yeah, I don't want to get into that. Dave Mustaine deserves so much credit for what heavy metal is. He doesn't get as much credit because of various things, but he was there writing Kill 'Em All with Metallica. He wrote, you know, three or four songs on Ride the Lightning. He helped develop that sound. There's no cheap version of Metallica with Megadeth, you know, and, you know, I can understand if people don't like his singing style and his voice, but there's a, you know, like I was saying with Motorhead, there's kind of a punky side to Megadeth. There's a little attitude there that you don't really hear in a lot of other bands. On an album like Peace Sells, though, he took the aggression and the anger he was feeling and he put it into this really intricate, like we were saying with Master Puppets, it's a very sophisticated album, especially when you go into like My Last Words or you go into Devil's Island. There's some songs on there, and just the way that they play, there's a jazz side to it. There's, you know, like a lot of Gare Samuelson, I can't remember how he pronounced it. The way that he drummed is very jazzy, and the guitarist on that album, Chris Poland, was a jazz guy too. And so there's just this, you know, intensity to it. And then obviously then they would have this a very direct song like Peace Sells, which was the MTV News theme for a long time, just because it has that incredible bass line.
Let's hear Peace Sells, the title track from Megadeth.
And he's funny.
Yeah.
He has funny, witty lyrics, which is another thing like Lemmy too, like that. Like what do you mean I'm not kind? I'm just not your kind. You know what I mean? This is that attitude I'm talking about.
The lead guitarist on this album, didn't he then like leave the band, and then Dave Mustaine wrote a song about him called Liar? Isn't that a thing that happened?
I'm not exactly sure if it was Chris Poland or not, but yeah, they had their issues. You know, this is the album. The other thing about this album is, unlike the first album where they blew all their production costs on drugs, they snorted it, they did all sorts of things to that money. This one sounds good. This one is like you can actually hear what's going on. It's a really smart record.
Next in our top 10 is Ozzy Osbourne, Blizzard of Oz. Brittany Spanos, what do you love about that album?
I think that when I first got into metal, like that, like Ozzy embodied everything that like represented metal to me. And I feel like his entire stage presence, like seeing him at Ozfest, you know, it was like such a pivotal moment in understanding what metal can be and what it sounds like live and like what it sounds like on record. And Crazy Train especially is something that's continued to be so popular. And I think that album is just such a pivotal moment in like what, like kind of the theatrics of metal and just the darkness of it. And he embodied all of that.
Randy Rhoads is, for anyone who like kind of grew up reading guitar magazines, like Randy Rhoads looms large, like such a spectacular and unique guitar player.
He's a god.
He is a god.
You know, he came up around the same time as Eddie. Nobody knows who did the tapping thing first. It might have been Randy. And the sound on that record is just so different from what Black Sabbath did. It was so modern compared to Black Sabbath because of that
little neoclassical major key stuff. Like, yeah, obviously he died very young, and so we mm-hmm. missed out on a lot of what could have been defining sort of metal music from him. So that album kind of stands as a testament to that as well. And number 10 on our list is Pantera, Vulgar Display of Power. How key is the fact that this sort of ugly, solid-state tone, is that decision actually key to the awesomeness of Pantera?
It's part of it, but I think that it really is just the fact that they were a unit. There was the, you know, Vinnie Paul's just aggressive, like, the way he drummed is just incredible, the way that it sounds. I'm sure Hank can speak to that, too. But also, Phil Anselmo's voice. And I have to give credit to one of our former Rolling Stone staffers, Brandon Geist, who's always said that Phil is the one guy that just sounds like a man when he's like singing and he's up there, and he just has that sound when he's singing Walk, when he's singing, you know, fucking Hostile and all that sort of thing. He just sounds like a man, and he just has that masculinity that maybe isn't in other things, but there's just something about that. There's a toughness to that you didn't really hear on maybe some of the other records that were coming out in 1992.
I think that album is like the quintessential, in a lot of ways, a quintessential 90s metal album. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously different things were happening. New metal is a whole nother strain of things, but Pantera, there's just like a sleekness and just a kind of a meanness to it, and it just sort of grooves in a whole different way than you know, thrash was sort of the paradigm. Pantera is like, let's keep that, you know, that speed when we need it, but also we can like downshift into, you know, like a song like Walk, like Corey was saying. It's just like this
it's a shuffle.
Yeah, exactly, just like extreme groove, you know.
Well, let's hear that. Can't you see I'm easily bothered by persistence, one step from lashing out at you. Yes, that Texas, it could be Pride and Joy by Stevie Ray Vaughan. This is the same shuffle, but yeah, it is the Texas in there. So that's our top 10. I wanted to, there's so much to talk about on this list, but one of the things that makes it great is its sort of idiosyncrasies and the sort of guiding ideas behind it, which help bring in things that some people might not say are not metal, or the one album that you guys define as metal by a band, like, for example, Women and Children First by Van Halen, which is really interesting in the sense that I think the idea is that that all the other albums are hard rock, but there they managed to make a metal album. Is that the thinking?
Yeah, that is. I mean, it is their most metal album, like, especially when, you know, like,
for sure,
everybody loves, you know, Van Halen 1, and there's obviously no slight to that. But on Women and Children First, there's just the, you know, the Cradle Will Rock, you know, there's, you know, Everybody Wants Some. It's metal, it's heavy, it's got kind of this party thing that David Lee Roth can only do, but the riffing on there, especially from Eddie, is just incredibly heavy.
And there's a Melvins album on here. There's a Soundgarden album. There's also an Evanescence album, Fallen, which for some reason, given all the kind of like idiosyncratic and interesting things on the list, that's the one that's controversial. Interesting. Brittany, I know that you were a big proponent of that. What was your thinking behind including this album?
I mean, for a lot of the same reasons that Corey and Hank outlined very early on, I think that Evanescence does embody a lot of what metal has always been. I mean, there is the darkness, and also we didn't really get into like the mythology behind a lot of the lyrics and the stories in, you know, a lot of early Sabbath and Dio, and a lot of these bands have these very like mythological kind of grandiose stories that they're telling in a lot of their songs. And I think that Evanescence, they embody a lot of what metal has always been, and their sound was definitely obviously like very new metal leaning. It was very gothic, kind of the alt metal scene that was going on in the early 2000s. And I mean, with Amy Lee's voice, that's really in line with Bruce Dickinson, that's in line with Ronnie James Dio, and that's the kind of operatic, really just like powerful booming voice that she has. And it's also very unapologetically feminine, which I mean, metal is also very defined by machismo and by, you know, masculinity. And I think something like Evanescence, that also broke through the mainstream, I think Fallen really represents what where metal was going in the early 2000s.
Fair enough. There's just other stuff that's really interesting. Faith No More's Angel Dust, an album I've always loved, and that it always was seen as kind of a proto-new metal album, but you guys decided it was, in fact, a metal album. What was the thinking there, and how much was there any question whether that should be included?
I think Hank maybe questioned a little bit. I didn't have a problem with it. Do you want to explain, Hank? And what swayed you?
I mean, you know, I think that Mike Patton, I guess just as sort of like a creative force, like he's obviously, he's someone who really represents this kind of like oddball streak in metal, that there's a whole movement that just kind of springs from him. And I think especially looking forward into his project Phantomus, where he really just sort of like was like slicing and dicing metal into this weird avant-garde composery thing that our colleague Chris Weingarten had sort of cited. Another record on this list, Naked City, was a big influence on Mike Patton. Anyway, but I think that Faith No More represents
like a John Zorn thing.
A John Zorn project. I think that Faith No More represents like a sort of oddball streak in metal with a lot of humor and a lot of kind of like just experimental ideas that has become its own tradition of itself. And Faith No More is an absolute ground zero for a lot of people working in that vein, I guess I would say.
It's also heavy.
Yeah, exactly.
What are you guys happiest that you managed to get on the list that might not have been an obvious inclusion, Hank?
My personal favorite metal album is Morbid Angel's Covenant. And so that was one that I was, you know, obviously I was just kind of pushing pretty hard for from the beginning. In terms of this sort of ferocity element that we talked about with Slayer, to me, when I first heard Morbid Angel, to be honest, it just terrified me. And that's what I want out of metal. I want it to, that's what I love about it, is that it's just, holy shit, what was that? And that, to me, that summed that up more than any other like metal experience I've had in my life. So that was the one for me.
Brittany, besides Evanescence, what's your favorite album on this list?
System of a Down's Toxicity is probably my favorite album of all time, but also my favorite metal album. And I think that and Alice in Chains' Dirt, I'm really glad that we were able to include them.
And Corey, what are you happiest that you managed to get on the list, and you know, what are your favorite stuff?
The one thing that I felt like I really had to make a case for, and like as for favorites, the top 10 are my favorites. You know, like most of this list are my favorites. There's a you know, there's a couple that came up in the voting process that I don't love as much, but obviously felt were warranted. But the one that I made the biggest case for was Soundgarden's Louder Than Love. And Soundgarden have been just so mired in the whole grunge thing and the label and all of that stuff. But that is a metal album, and I wanted people to realize that that was a metal album and that it was a great metal album on top of that.
I mean, it's interesting because when I first experienced Bad Motorfinger, when it first came out, I experienced it as a metal album. I assumed it was a metal album. I didn't even know it was possible with something else.
Mm-hmm.
Hank, what are the kind of other kind of extreme choices on this list?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you know, looking at kind of like the bottom reaches of the list, I think, you know, honestly, a band like Sun, you know, for people listening, that's the band S-U-N-N with kind of the weird zero symbol after it. You know, again, another one strongly advocated for by Chris Weingarten. But it really shows you how far, you know, people have really pushed this idea. Sun being a band where it's basically like, let's remove the drums, let's stretch out the riffs to these like half hour, you know, drone pieces or something like that. But still, you know, they come on stage in these robes and they're like embodying the spirit of metal while almost like, you know, taking the ground out from underneath it or something like that.
It's a feeling more than it's music.
Yeah.
Guys, thank you so much for being here to talk about Rolling Stone's list of 100 greatest metal albums of all time, and there's a ton of music to explore. I doubt anyone reading it has already heard all the albums. And this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. And we'll be back next week at 1 p.m. on Volume. In the meantime, download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, and we will see you next week.